In late 2017, my husband Chris joined forces with Scott Philbrook and Forrest Burgess for the first time to create a follow-up episode to one of Astonishing Legends' earliest investigations. Since then, their bond has evolved into a deep friendship, making them not just colleagues in podcasting, but also cherished personal friends of ours. So when Chris informed me that they would finally be appearing on our show, I couldn't resist seizing the opportunity to introduce them. Without further ado, it's my pleasure to present to you my dear friends, Scott Philbrook and Forrest Burgess, the renowned hosts of the world-famous Astonishing Legends podcast.
Back Scott and Forrest.
That's a line that Scott wrote for me to say, just because.
Okay, well then I'm stealing a portion of Scott and Forrest then to start this.
We operate as one half brain. It's like we have a quarter brain each, and then together we're about half a brain, and we get the show done.
That's how it works. Well, Astonishing Legends is the podcast, in case you've been living under a rock for the past 8 or 9 years. You know, let me just start this off by saying, you know how I feel about you both. I don't need to say that, but thank you for doing this tonight. I really, really appreciate you coming on this show in particular with me. So thank you both for this.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Dude, you're family. Yeah, you're part of the early Podern family here with all of us, in that it's so weird to think that we try to tackle a subject like Amelia in our fourth episode.
Third and fourth,
just thinking like, this is really fascinating. We can knock this out in one. And then Scott, I think it was about like 11:30 p.m. maybe it was a Friday night or so, because we were still working, so we would have to do some of this on the weekends. And it's like, oh my goodness, we have so much more material to get to. There's so much more interesting things to talk about with her and the case. And it's like, what are we going to do? Because now it's just running long. And that's the first one where we said, you don't have to, you can do multiple parts, right? Mm-hmm. And we looked at each other like, yeah, I guess you can. There's no network notes. You don't have to stick in, 48 minutes with commercials or anything like that, like TV does. So you can do whatever you want. And that was a very liberating moment. And for better or worse, that freedom allows you to really cover something in the way that you feel you can do it justice. Yeah. So that was a huge revelation for us. Like, I guess we can do two parts. Mm-hmm. Let's do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And boy, you guys have, and we'll get to multiple parts in a little bit. I just want to start by taking it back and discuss the origins of what would become Astonishing Legends, because everybody's got a great story. You guys have got a fantastic one. Before we get to the show, how do you guys link up? I know we've talked about this offline privately. How do you guys initially meet? What takes this from an idea to a concept to a product?
We met a long time ago through mutual friends. We were sort of in outlying circles of other friends we were close to. Essentially, we were friends of friends. So what would happen is, anytime the friends would have a get together of the larger group, we were always there and we would talk and hang out. And I had always known that Forrest enjoyed discussing weird esoteric things, and a lot of times at a party I would seek him out. I'm not a big party guy. Like, I get bored at parties, so I'd like, wait, who am I gonna talk to about something interesting? So he and I used to hang out and talk about weird things, and I remember thinking, God, this guy really knows a lot of weird information that most people don't know, and it's stuff that I like talking about too. But that was the whole thing. We still were just like hanging out with friends. We had mutual friends. We all worked in post-production in Los Angeles, so everything was overlapping. That was a small world, small, busy, crazy, exciting world at the time. In the year 2000, we were all living in LA at this time. I moved away for 10 years out of LA because my wife got work in New York City. So we moved to New York City 5 days after 9/11 because there was a thing. Events were already unfolding. She had gotten hired to be a writer on a TV show. So it was like, we were not going to not do that. So we went to New York. And when I left, I thought I would not only not see Forrest, but most of my LA friends probably ever again, most of them.
Mm-hmm. Here's a good question, though. Yeah. Scott recently, the other day, like 2 days ago, found a photo of a trip that the fellas took.
Yes.
And in the photo, it's funny, as he's known in the episode, Marty from the Queen Mary episode, episode number two.
Astonishing Legends.
We'd rented a houseboat and we're camping out at Bass Lake here in California at the gateway to the Sierras for like 3 or 4 days. And that was a really fun trip. But Scott, that was 2002?
No, I think that was, hang on, let me just look. I was going to try to look. No, it couldn't have been because I was in, no, I was in New
York.
That's
what I'm wondering.
So I don't think it was, but it was a long time ago. I was looking for it now, but I might not be able to find it.
That's just the odd thing, Chris, is, and I'm sure as you look back on your journey with Chasing Earhart when you first started, I mean, we've always asked you in an interview, when did you get excited about this topic, per se?
Yeah.
And you said, was it third grade when you wrote a report on her?
Yeah, third grade.
You were hooked then, and then you could see the progression. But for me, I have trouble calculating date ranges, and I'm often very surprised when I see something, it's like, that's when we did that? It seems so long ago, yet time has really flown by. And we just the other day, we were wondering when we had gone to the Sally House. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, that had to have been like 2017, 2018, but that 2018. Was the year.
Oh yeah, it was December, right. December 2002, yeah. Forrest. I just found the pictures. So yeah, that was December 2002. So I must've come back to LA for some reason, for a visit or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was, that couldn't have been, it looked like summer. I'm not sure.
Let me just see. I'm looking at one right now. Yeah, December 15th, 2002. I mean, it's always summer in LA, isn't
okay.
it? I mean,
well, yeah, but up in the mountains. Point being is that we would gather for a few of these things, but we didn't really hang out a lot because, again, he was more mobile. He's working across town, but we all worked in post-production in some realm. That was kind of the Venn diagram of everything, is that we had a background in video and audio production and film and working on and small films. And so we were all familiar in that realm. And I think that owed a lot of it gave a lot of impetus to trying to attempt a podcast, because Scott and I, we had tried to do a, Scott will talk a little bit about Reality Feed, because we've mentioned a few times here, but that was a great idea, I think ahead of its time, but that was a media internet posting idea for a start of a platform, but it was way before you had YouTube and really streaming. So it would have been web-based, website-based, where people shared clips of interesting things, and everybody was essentially your village videographer journalist. That was way before that. It's like, what's going on in your little town? Why don't you take a video of it and send it in, and everybody learns about each other. And it was a great idea for...
It would have evolved into YouTube. And we had a full business plan and pitched it to venture capitalists and everything. And it was all 24 months before YouTube.
No way.
Yeah. We talked to a guy who was with Liberty Media. He could have written a check. That's a subset of AT&T. And he said, I don't think this will ever take off.
What a bombshell way to start this conversation, by the way. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It's cool. It was a cool idea, but it was, like Forrest said, it was ahead of its time. The tech wasn't there yet, and the people weren't ready to be producing video on that. It seemed like a no-brainer to me, because I was already an editor, and all of our people were in post-production. We were like, well, we know how to post video, even though it was blocky and crappy looking. We knew how to do it, and we knew it would get better, but it wasn't to the point where it is now. Literally, everybody just hits a button and they're live streaming, so it wasn't, you know, but anyway.
That's such a major aspect of this, and when I look back on the last 15, 20 years philosophically about how we've come and how this all came together. And, you could look at that too. It's like, we wouldn't have met Chris had we not posted a show on Amelia Earhart, had he not found that. And then we find these other people. And then through Chris, we have the Sally House experience. That was life-changing. And then all these things happen. And that's the way life works. There's invisible gears, massive gears, like a town square watch clock tower that are turning in the background that you can't see. But stuff is in motion. People you haven't met yet. Mm-hmm. Opportunities that are coming your way. Only if you do certain things. So all that is to say, when we were thinking about this, or when that idea for Reality Feed came, that was before really there was the way to edit all this crap on your phone. It didn't even have to look good. I mean, here's the thing. People back then, when Scott and I were working in television, there was an idea of what was called broadcast standards. And they didn't want you to post GP3 video format from your mobile phone on regular broadcasting standards and platforms. And so But here's the point is that, yeah, we all worked in post-production. I worked at a place that was doing a lot of corporate videos, mostly for automotive companies and sales and training and events. You know, I had access to a Betacam SP edit bay, and that looked pretty good. It was a pretty high quality. I had access to a Canon Hi8 and HD cam camera. And, you know, there was a bit of a process there. You'd shoot video, then transfer that to Beta SP, and then edit with that, and then end up with a thing. And then you end up, I guess the idea was that you would mail in, this is how old it was, a VHS tape, or you'd have to lay it off to a tape. Then that could be uploaded to a server and put on the website. And so you can't do that just from your phone now, you know, that stuff like you can nowadays. And so the ease was there. And then also what I noticed, like, well, I'm working long days. I mean, like 10, 12, 14 hour days on video. I don't exactly want to sit here for another 2 or 3 hours tonight until 11 p.m. working on a side video. Even with all that equipment, the point was it wasn't that easy still. And so then you imagine people who don't have all that. It's like, well, I got dad's VHS-C cam. I could shoot a little bit of video here, but it's harder to edit. That is not such an easy thing to do, or put up graphics and all that stuff. So it wasn't that accessible as it is now. And so the larger point is that the pieces of the puzzle have not yet lined up. And just where we are now, I wish I could have been doing this job like Jim Harold had done in 2005, but it wasn't, you know, you didn't have the major sponsors to keep you afloat. Like, you know, he had the foresight to wonder, like, okay, I think there's a living that could be made with this. If I get a couple of sponsors, just each episode, just to pay for itself at least, and then maybe we have as he's had running, the Paranormal Plus Club. And it's like, maybe if you do a subscription, then I'll give you, and he's a workhorse. I mean, he's got like an extra 5 podcasts.
He's coming out with a new podcast like every week. He's remarkable.
Yeah.
He texted me about a new one he's thinking about yesterday.
He's remarkable.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a giant. For sure.
There was a little bit of a skip in time there. The jump is that I was gone for 10 years, 9.5 years.
Yeah.
And then I came back to LA because my wife got a job, offered a job back in LA. She and I were about to settle back down in North Carolina where we met. And I came back, but at the time I had a 10-month-old and I was a stay-at-home dad for a couple of years. And so in the beginning, but then when he got old enough to go to school, I was like, I got to go back to work. And that's when Forrest and I started talking about the podcast. And that was probably like 2012, because it took us 2 years of talking really before we even put the first episode up. And
2010, 2011, we started, that's what I was saying. It was a backyard party. And I kind of remember the instance. It doesn't matter who uttered the first words, but I've been listening to podcasts by then because I would go to the gym and it's like, well, I don't really care for the music they're pumping in here and I need to listen to something else. Why not have it be informative? And I'd heard of this new kind of format that's free. And if you have, I had an old, really like an iPod mini, and it's like, oh, you can load these through iTunes. You can load on these shows. It's like, well, that's cool. Let me hit this one. And I was listening to shows like Stuff You Should Know.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a great show. It's like, man, two guys, these are really fun. And you learn a little bit. You're curious about the guys. They're having fun banter or the news. But this is still new and there wasn't much advertising. Mm-hmm. They are able to do that because their parent company is How Stuff Works, right? So that's a web-based. Right. Yeah, so they had some money, and so like, well, let's try and do this, and it got kind of popular. And that's when, you know, Scott and I were talking. It's just like, that was the load into doing this is that, well, we both enjoy talking about this weird stuff, and Reality Feed itself was kind of getting stuck and mired down and didn't look like anybody was going to buy it on that. It was too expensive and time consuming for us to do it just to do it on our own.
Yeah.
When no one's looking at it. So we decided, you know, just for a creative outlet, he and I were talking. It's like, hey, you know, we both like to talk about this kind of stuff. You know, we could produce a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, okay, yeah, what was that? What would that involve? It's like, well, okay, first of all, like I said, we both have backgrounds in post-production. So we know how to record the audio. We know and have the means to edit the audio. And we both have backgrounds in marketing and advertising a little bit. So yeah, we can publicize this. We can kind of get this project going and have fun just doing something on the side, just besides the jobs we were doing, our daily grind. So just for fun and a creative outlet. And I don't think we were even thinking about making any money with it.
Well, I was hopeful. I was hopeful that someday, eventually,
right.
it might yeah. generate income. Yeah,
sure.
I was hopeful.
Yeah. Okay. So then we had an idea. It's like, well, what do we both like? Well, we like strange, fascinating historical stories, stories about weird phenomena. Like we talked about the dead water phenomena,
yeah.
time slips and vortexes. And it was not so much ghosts and UFOs. It was more about just odd stories that would pop up. Or I guess some ghosts. It's like the two heads that showed up that was taking a photo of the in the ocean next to the schooner
right.
that are in the water of two crew members that died. And it really looks like their photos. And it's like, let's just talk about that kind of stuff. That's interesting. And
yeah.
so we had a genre. And then I started like, okay, well, I'm already listening to podcasts. Let me take a look to see what other types of shows are out there like that.
Right.
And there was two other guys. And funny, I think one guy was actually a commercial cable video editor and his partner who were both paranormal investigators and would do ghost hunting. And they had a podcast, which I really enjoyed, but they only did like six of them. There was Jim Harold, and he had two shows on, and one was the campfire. And I was like, that's a great idea because people have great stories out there. And here's a way to collect them. Unlike Reality Feed, where you are asking them to record it and maybe edit and send it in, you just have them come on and you interview them and you just let them tell their story.
Yeah.
And so that was a great idea. And the other one was like, man, he's getting all these interviews with all these researchers and authors in with really fascinating subjects. And I wondered, like, how is he getting all these? Mm-hmm. And I think just because it's a fringe genre. So he would just ask them.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
And they started coming on. And after after a few years, he had quite a collection. And I think to this point, the biggest collection of people in the metaphysical, paranormal, strange news, science, all these fields that have come on his show, it is really quite the repository. So,
yeah.
But I noticed, talking about sponsors, that it was an early sponsor for earbuds.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the kind that are wooden. It's like, oh, I'd heard that, the wood makes it for a really good resonance, really comfortable smoothing it out. And Jim was offering a discount, like 15%. Like, well, I need new earbuds. Hmm. And I like Jim, so I want him to get the credit. So I used his code and bought some earbuds. And that's the way it works. It's like, well, I hope he gets enough of these that support him.
Yeah.
And eventually it did, but it took a long time. And still nobody took podcasting seriously until they saw big money could be made. And then when that happens, then celebrities have a vanity podcast they want to put on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And every business has their,
yeah.
I think we talked about the barkeeper's friend, the terrific oxalic acid cleansing powder that we talked about with Delphus Ring. And I think they have a podcast. Yeah. So everybody
has a podcast. And you touched on it early when we first started the show, started talking about it. And I'll ask you to elaborate a little bit on this. What you guys do is so complex that you often do need to split stories into multiple episodes.
Yeah.
So you got some really famous examples of that in the archive of Astonishing Legends. How do you guys approach the research and the storytelling so that you can give the listenership a strong comprehension on the topic at hand? I mean, I know you guys are not, you talk about not being a deep dive podcast, but really, I mean, I feel, right. and your listeners probably would agree with me, that you guys absolutely yeah. are a very deep dive podcast. How do you do that?
That stems from a couple of determining factors. One of them, well, we didn't have to think about this quite as much as we did now. We knew that when we started in 2012, like there's a lot of podcasts out there, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. Mm-hmm. I think at the time that might have been 500,000 to 700,000 podcasts were out there. But like I said, it's a hard thing to keep up. So a lot of people would try them. You got a full-time day job and you get home. It's like, that's the last thing you want to work on. And you, if you got somebody else, you have to, your schedules have to align, so that's hard. People would do 3 or 4 episodes and then like kind of give up.
Mm-hmm.
Say, well, our friends are listening, but we talk to them anyway, like no one else is kind of bothering. So what the deal is that we would think about how to stand out. That's a major thing. Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, how do we do that? Well, we should develop a style first. We have these interesting and unique subject matter and stories that we've collected, but everybody's on the internet. Anybody can get to these.
Yeah.
Who has an interest in it.
Right.
And it is a fringe genre, but we decided like, okay, well, if nobody's really curbing us or monitoring us or giving us studio executive notes about what we should do and don't do and how long it should be, let's just keep talking about this kind of thing until we've discussed everything that we find interesting about it. And I think that's the balance of like, okay, we might find it interesting, but we have to keep in mind the listener. Mm. Let's not start to bore them, right? We don't want to just info barf on them and have, it's just like too much stuff or things that generally might be of specific interest to us in our nerdy ways, but generally would not be. So we approach the research on it to the degree that we want to. It's pretty much everything we want to say. And we do leave out whole chunks. Scott and I have wasted so much work when we can't coordinate with each other. Like, I got this whole section on this weird thing that happened in a nearby town. It was only like 10 miles away. It was at the same time. It was very similar. Like, you know, let's say our thing is like, let's.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, it's just same. Like, we should have discussed this with each other that this wasn't needed. And then at some point, like when we're recording, we'll realize like, this is getting long. Because we don't know how much we have to say about each thing, even with bullet points and notes. Mm-hmm. He and I might start, it might spark a really interesting conversation. Like, he's like, well, I think it's this way. It's like, well, I don't think so. What about this? He's like, yeah, but I don't agree. You know, and that'll get us going. I say we agree enough on topics to be functional,
yeah,
as opposed to dysfunctional. And we disagree just enough to keep it interesting.
Yeah.
Because if we agreed on everything, it'd be like, okay, there right. should be really just one of us here. So
that's an immediate cut. The more work you've done.
That's what happened. We're both tired.
Well, we had a 30-minute argument the other night that before we even got through the end of it, we were like, we're going to have to cut this, I think.
That goes Patreon on Patreon. Bonus.
But I don't think it's, I don't know if it's ever going to see the light of day, though, because I don't even think it was relevant to or germane to anything we were discussing, really. Now I can.
Here's the thing. I mean, it was a non-professional moment. What I would say, though, is that because he and I are friends.
An NPF.
Right. Yeah, he and I are friends. You know, we're both busy, and we don't often get... I'm free when he's not, and vice
right,
versa.
That's hard.
So we don't get to chat as friends, which was the impetus for this podcast. You know, it's like, look, if we didn't like each other, we're just like, oh my God, this is drudgery. And a lot of times it is, just doing the research and getting in the studio and having to do all the, jump through the hoops and do all the admin stuff that Scott mostly handles. It's a lot. And if we didn't enjoy talking to each other, like, this would have been done about the first 18 months. But here's the thing. So the point is, like, finally, it's like, oh, now we have a chance. We have to record tonight. So we're on there, and we're just like, now we've lapsed, and it's late. It's even later for him. He's 3 hours ahead. Mm-hmm. And we've lapsed into, like, one of our famous, fun, friendly, maybe a little contentious discussions about, you think this is fake? Well, I'm not so sure. Well, I'm pretty sure it's fake. Oh, I don't know about that. And then, you know, next thing you know, and we're pulling out all these things that we both know. And I think that adds, I would say, totally uniqueness to our show, but it adds an angle that our points of view and what we think about and bring to the show should be and is a little different than the other shows out there. And like I said, I think there's other people that are really doing it great that we've become friends with. Adam and Matt over at Graveyard Tales. We love those guys.
Shout out to Adam and Matt.
Shout out to those guys. Tales. Like, I think, they do it just enough time for the topics. And it's one that if I manage to get jogging, I'll punch in a couple of those because it's the right amount of time. You end up knowing everything about it. Their voices are very pleasing. That's another aspect to it.
They have some sexy voices.
They do have some sexy, soothing tones, and that is can't be ignored. That's part of it. And people starting out, you know, when I hear them, it's like, you might not want to just record in your dining room. It's very echoey. It's very boomy.
Right.
Put a little time into making it sound good. You're going to have to do everything you possibly can to once you get somebody listening, you need to hang on to them because there's 600,000 other shows to listen to, and that's not an exaggeration.
In the genre, probably.
Yeah, it's 3 million now or something. Yeah, something ridiculous or 5 million.
The number gets more and more ridiculous. Yeah. Well, there are two things I really want to talk to you guys about because it's relatively new. One of them I'm very excited to talk about. The first one I want to talk about, though, I want to bring it up, is the Astonishing Junk Drawer. You guys have launched that. That's gotten really popular with your fan base. Tell me first, why do that? I think I have an idea of maybe why you guys decided to do that. But can you tell me a little bit about sort of, you know, the conception of that and the launch of that and how it's been going.
First, tell us your idea. Give us your theory on why we're doing this. Why are we doing more work?
Well, why does anybody do more work? I think the reason why, and I could be certainly wrong, but you guys, what you cover, it's you cast such a wide net in what you guys cover. There's so much information out there, and I feel like Astonishing Junk Drawer can kind of serve two different really purposes. It can allow you to sort of talk about some things, some news of the week, some important topics, some things you maybe didn't get a chance to talk about on the show. Maybe you can interact with some fans a little bit more. It's a little more of an intimate experience for your fans. It's become quite popular. I mean, I just amongst the group and hearing the chatter in the Astonishing Legends group, which I'm of course very proudly a part of. Tell me the concept behind that. Why did you guys decide to go that route?
One of the things about having a Patreon is that people expect more. They want to get stuff that the regular for listeners to the free show aren't getting. Right. And for a long time, we were trying to figure out what kind of rewards could we have up there. You know, the bonus content, these other things that we wanted to do. One of the ideas that we had was like, you know, why don't we do, you know, do something that is from a post-production standpoint and a pre-production standpoint, a little bit simpler, quicker, mm-hmm. shoot from the hip, and more intimate for those folks that support us on Patreon, to make the Patreon actually worth more than just, you know, hey, we want to help out Astonishing Legends. It's like, let's do something fun in there. At first, we were actually having them edited and everything, but that didn't seem like the right move with it. So we started doing them live on video, which was a little scary. But then once you do that over and over, you start getting used to it, you find out that you've built a new muscle, which is nice to have for all kinds mm-hmm. of reasons, especially since the trend for all things podcasting is going towards video anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to have that in our toolkit now. It just got to be really fun in the casual nature of the conversation. And like you said, it gives us a chance to touch on things that wouldn't make a full episode. It gives us a chance to be more candid, a little more relaxed, because the other great thing about Patreon is it's safe space for us. Everybody in there, they're already in there because we know they like us. It's not a high troll quotient. You got to be a hardcore troll to pay money to troll somebody. Yeah. So that's like,
well, oh, there's people who people that do
no,
that.
No, they'll pay.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
True.
No, it's worth it to... them to, because it's like therapy for them. Mm-hmm. They get to yell at us with zero consequence, but and why not pay for that? It's cheaper than therapy. So
that's a good point.
But most people, now here's the thing, they will push back. I mean, there's a lot of smart people in there.
Yeah, sure.
We'd like to think that our audience, you included, a lot of smart technical people with great ideas, and they'll push back on an idea if they say, like, hey, I don't know about that. You know, have you considered this? And we'll have a little interplay with them. But it's also the other thing I think we were not expecting over the years, and you can. I think every show starts off this way because you don't know. Unless you're fooling yourself and some people have. There was a business article on LinkedIn, I think, that these two young entrepreneurs were thinking they got let go. This is probably back in 2019, 2020. And they were like, hey, you know what? How do we make a lot of money in a little bit of time for very little effort, which I think is everybody's goal. But they were like, well, hey, we could start a podcast. And I'll bet you in about a year we'll be making $1 million each.
Right.
Or just we'll split the million. Yeah. And it's like, okay, well, you might if you solve a crime.
Right.
You might.
Right.
If you commit a crime and publicize that, the idea though is that you could put that in there and there's no guarantee of what's going to happen. So what we were doing is calling for stories. Mm-hmm. I think what we weren't expecting is how many we would eventually get and right. how many people had strange encounters, unexplainable things. And they're like, hey, I don't want to tell my family or friends because they kind of laugh and they roll their eyes and they slap me on the back. And then
it's not the right environment
to say, oh, I'm just joking.
Yeah.
It's not the right environment.
Right.
And you don't have the right audience because they don't know what to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what
mm-hmm.
do you mean you have this black misty specter of smoke coming out of your Schiffer robe at night? I don't know. Okay. So they come to us and they said, hey, what do you guys think about this? I can't be the only one, right? And it's like, no, you're not.
Hmm.
So we have so many great stories that have built up over the years and everything else too. Authors, people who write books on this, nonfiction and fiction, people who normally give talks about things in this realm and just fascinating historical stuff. And we don't have enough time or the wherewithal to put them all on the air, but they deserve to be heard, I think. It's like, okay, well, how can we whittle that down a little? Well, we can have a sideshow where it's just less informal, doesn't have quite, you know, of course, not the same listenership, but it's a fair number of people and they get out there. And eventually we're thinking about releasing those because the patrons, yes, as Scott was saying, we want to treat them.
Mm-hmm.
It's so generous of them. And we're so grateful and appreciative
that they would give us any money at all when everything out there's a subscription that starts at $5.99 a month up to, you know, what's Netflix now, $39? I don't know.
It's gonna be
$31. It's all getting there, and everyone's fatigued about just giving everybody money, and I signed up for this thing and I forgot to cancel it, and I'm 6 months in and I forgot I'm even paying for it and I haven't looked at it. So everybody is stretched thin, especially these days, and they've decided to give us some of their hard-earned coin, and we want to, like I said, we want to give that back. But like, what could we do that was a little different maybe than what other shows were doing? So basically it's not quite a rewind show, mm-hmm. although we may talk about certain topics, but it's the stuff that we can't get to. Like I said, we get so many people we've come across that either just through reached out through email or our fellow podcasters or in this community that we have built up. We don't have time to put them all on the show, but we would like to give them some airtime, and mostly we just want to chat with them and get to know them better.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. I got to tell you, I'm excited to talk about this. So I was a little bit privy to this. You guys played this pretty close to the chest when it was initially in development. And this is my show, so I can cuss if I want, damn it. I'm going to talk to you guys about the Midnight Library. It's one of the most brilliant fucking concepts for a podcast I have ever heard. Yeah. And this is not an ego stroke. When you guys came up with the concept and you were talking about doing something really kind of different and interesting and kind of putting an AL twist on it, you know, I'm intrigued enough there. But when I listened to the initial episode, and I just got to tell you, like, it's like the production quality of it is really incredible. It feels like an audible version of the Haunted Mansion. That's what it feels like.
Wow. Miranda would love that to hear.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, I'll plant the seed right now. I would love to have Miranda on this show at some point to talk about her experiences at the library, a little bit of historical context maybe. But okay. Yeah, I just want to ask you guys about sort of the same concept here. Let's talk about development. I know, Scott, you guys are working on this for a while. This is something you put some time and effort into. It's obviously a different approach. It's a different twist on AL and what you guys do normally. Tell me about the Midnight Library.
Well, the Midnight Library, I guess one of the things I would say about it is that it became its own thing under Miranda's guidance, mm-hmm. really, mm-hmm. because we had some ideas about it. She had been reaching out to us a long time ago and sending us voicemails. You know how we have our listener segues. We would get these voicemails from this person. And I remember hearing her voice and being like, she's got an amazing voice. Mm-hmm. I really
she
like
does.
Yeah, and I love her mm-hmm. disposition and the things she was sending in. We were talking about trying to come up with ways to do more shows and branch out. We had an opportunity to meet her in person when we went to the Kent Paranormal Weekend in Ohio, which was one of those that's when Forrest was talking about how these things you don't realize they're happening. Mm-hmm. That was a really pivotal moment in our show's trajectory and Astonishing Legends trajectory. It's when we met Jim Harold and mm-hmm. became friends with him. It's when we met Seth Breedlove, who we're now very close to as well. It's when we also met Miranda. So we started pitching the thing to her. My wife is, as I alluded to earlier, she's been in television and movie business for a while. So it was like, I could develop something. Let's develop this, Forrest. And Forrest was like, okay, you know. And so we gave it a shot. And Miranda didn't have, like us, you know, we had post-production experience and, you know, all kinds of different creative experience. And she didn't really have that. But she had her personality and her voice and her disposition. And it was a really cool thing to put some time into that. And so we worked on it for a while. And then we got to a point where we said to her, look, you know, why don't you take the reins on mm-hmm. this? You seem to know what it needs and what it wants. And she did. She took over the bulk of the work. And we pulled ourselves back to sort of just marketing support and being there for her when she has questions. And we helped the show get posted and everything. And she just really took it and ran with it. It's passed 5 million downloads now since it started.
Mm. Yeah. That was all her creative vision.
Yeah, it really was. It's really hers.
It's really all her. It's all her. We had a few ideas we kicked in, but it owes so much to her just curated tastes in this. And like, you know, when you meet somebody and they're like, oh, you like this too. Mm-hmm. And these kind of spooky, booky, macabre, vintage. There's so many descriptors that, you know, she and I will just personally text back and forth of like, hey, did you see this? Mm-hmm. And it's like all these kind of cool things. And you end up having the same taste. It's like, I know where you're going with this and I like it. Mm-hmm. So that just came out of her wildly creative imagination. As you were saying, Chris, the idea for that, when a show works, I mean, Scott and I have been working in this quite a long time.
And everybody has a background and interest that suits them if they're successful in this. Scott's wife certainly is a master, I think, at character.
Mm-hmm.
And what's funny about different characters.
She
and
is.
What's funny about human behavior. And, you know, that's one thing to be observant, but then you got to get into a script. You got to write jokes. So that's her strength. And I think what Scott and I figure here is the development of this type of structure, which is our strong suit's not so much narrative, but I think some of the best producers I've ever worked with had a vision that was realistic that they could achieve and get the right people to do it, but also they have to know what it's supposed to be like. And the very worst producers I've ever worked with in all of my media years are ones that were very unsure. And Scott's like, they have this idea, well, no, it has to fit this. That's the notes. I have to get this to work. It's like, no, this thing has a life of its own. Let it breathe and evolve. Blow some magical air into its lungs and let it be its right. own thing. And I saw that a little bit with her development of the idea that she had this concept. So she had this vision, started fleshing out the characters, adding more mm-hmm. characters. But she definitely had, as I would say, an idea, a vision of what it was supposed to be, even if all the pieces weren't there yet.
Well, let's change gears a little bit because I want to ask you guys something interesting. And we've talked about this ad nauseum off the record over the years, but I want to talk about it on the show, I think, because we all know how covering, you know, these kinds of topics that we cover as podcasters can be when you're trying to sort of please everybody and make something that everyone can enjoy. But that's not really possible, is it? So how do you guys deal with that? I guess the better question to ask is, how has the way you've dealt with that changed over the years since you've had the show?
You mean like trolls and negativity, that kind of thing?
Yeah, being called a bozo by Rick Gillespie and things like that. Well, you know, just
that is
lots
a badge
of different
of honor. Badge right. of honor for me.
Well, he's called me far worse. He's called me far worse. So.
Yeah, we were a couple of bozos, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's what mm-hmm. we are. Yeah. So, you know what? I love that stuff. When you start out with something, I think any creative endeavor, it's not just podcasting, it's anybody. Any painter puts their first painting out, a poet writes a poem and shares it with their friends. You're always going to be a little bit on pins and needles. What sure. do people think? Or do they like this? And you get into this sort of feedback scenario. And in the course of that, early on, we were looking at reviews a lot mm-hmm. and just trying to make sure we were getting our foot in the door in a place that it was going to stay and that the show would grow and become a going concern as opposed to a hobby. We definitely looked at all that stuff. But one of the interesting things, if you come back to what I was saying about being gone 10 years mm-hmm. in New York, the reason I wouldn't have brought this up, it's not germane to the story necessarily, but the reason we were there was because my wife had been hired to write for Saturday Night Live. And the reason that I'm including that now,
it's good
is
reason
because yeah
it's a hell of
well,
a reason
that
you're
was why
go.
We went that's why we went in spite of 9/11 happening and all that first show after 9/11 with Rudy Giuliani on the stage with all the firefighters. That was her first show and it was also the night of her 30th birthday, so that was a big move for us. It was something she'd always wanted to do since a kid.
Good
so
Lord.
That's why we went to New York.
Amazing.
And she had an amazing journey there. That's a whole nother thing. But part of that journey was me watching how fans and feedback came in to the SNL people, mm-hmm. both interpersonally at the after parties and then also in the media. Just, oh, that show hasn't been funny since 1976. Just ad nauseum. Mm-hmm. Even with people who are riding in a limo with you to get steak at 2 a.m.
Friends and family who have been graciously invited by you.
Yeah. Just be like, well, that sketch was dumb, yeah. you know, or they're sitting at the table. It was unbelievable to me. And so over time, I learned how to deal with it. And she did too, to a certain extent. But you also learned a lot about people. As Forrest always says, we've learned more about people than we have the paranormal with mm-hmm. our show. And I learned that about people. So when we came back and started our show, even though it was new and I was as sensitive as I could be putting something new creative out there, I was like, I've seen this. Mm-hmm. I've seen this movie before when you mm-hmm. get the negative feedback. So at first we did engage. I never really engaged a lot though, because I realized the futility of that from my wife's experiences in New York. So I tried to not ever get super involved with, because people were very critical. There was things we did not do mm-hmm. right out of the gate. We talked too much. We interrupted each other too much. Our narrative structure was a little bit too sloppy.
Yeah, that's stuff you should pay attention to.
Yeah, that there's constructive criticism mm-hmm. in there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, we weren't doing the sound effects right, that kind of stuff. And so we've would fix those things, but other things were thematic or people, why can't you just do this? Or why can't you just get to the chase? Why can't, a lot of them, a lot of those always start with, why can't you just?
Or do it this, this other show does it this way. You should do it that way too. And it's like, well, that's that show.
Right.
And
that's when Forrest says, yeah, go listen to the other show.
It's
And that's, that does not fly well with them, because here's what I learned about that. And it is, it's not a nice thing often. It's negative. I don't know why for the life of me, somebody would waste their time with this, because I mean, that's one thing I saw on Reddit's been the, is part of the nastiest snake pit of trolls that you can come across. But you know, you get in there and some of it is, that's just the nature of that, that platform. But what I've noticed though, is that there's a psychology there. And at the very worst of it is what we've come to learn is the dark triad personality.
Mm-hmm.
Where it is, it's got laughs at me because I learned that term and now I use it all the time. But it, it is a, it's a mix of narcissism, Machiavellianism, and just a bit of psychosis.
Psychopathy. A little salt bay of psychosis.
It's a little bit because, well, that's the bay. That's the triangular part of it. The attitude is that it is a bit sociopathic in that you don't care if you're hurting the person's feelings. It's like their attitude is like, oh, I am absolutely right. You need to, it's going to hurt your feelings, man, but this is going to help you. You need to hear this. You need to hear my criticisms. I'm laying down these truth bombs. You need to pick them up, even if they blow up in your face and they scar you for life. I know what the right thing is, and you need to do it this way. And why don't you do it this way? So that's the one end of the spectrum, which is, it's just very toxic, to use a popular phrase. At the other end, what you notice is that people will harangue you, and then if you engage with them, a lot of times you'll get, it's like, no, you get me wrong. I love the show. I just like it when you guys do it this way, or I wanted to hear more about this, and you guys never talk about this aspect of whatever it is, and I want you to do it this way. And so it's part of it wanting so much to interact with it and be a part of something, but of course they want you to do it the way that they like. Or they have some suggestions, or it's just criticism. It's like, you know, a lot of times it's very, you read into it, you read their other posts, and it's something, there's a psychological profile that develops in that it's like, oh, you know, in their other job seems like, you know, they're complaining about this, like maybe the boss doesn't listen to them. Maybe their coworkers didn't like their the yearly report that they presented and people fell asleep. And so they take that out on you. There's a lot going on psychologically. But my point is that the other end of the spectrum is that they do like it. It's just that they don't express that in a healthy or likable manner. And there's a lot of disagreeableness to it. And so there's a bit of passive aggressiveness to it. And the sad part of aspect of that is that a lot of them seem very lonely. And that's not a dig at them. There's so many lonely people out there and they don't know what to do about it.
I understand that.
Loneliness is an epidemic right now. I keep reading articles about that.
It is seems to be, especially after you can't blame the pandemic for everything, but it didn't do any good. And what you're seeing now is that people, they don't know how to handle that. And so it's like that whole, speaking of The Simpsons earlier, it's like, when they went to, but they take Bart to Dr. Marvin Monroe, and he goes, Bart, you just like attention, whether it's good or bad. It doesn't matter. And that's what it happens. It's just like, well, I'll yell at you guys until you respond. But my point about that was that somebody said, like, why don't you get in here and really hash it out with us? Those guys are wimps and wussies. They don't.
I can't wait to do with my Sunday. I'm gonna go on Reddit.
And it's like, why?
Right.
My point is like, why will we both waste each other's time? Yeah. Like I know you're excited about this, but you need to find something else to do because
I need to say something, a little caveat here. There are a lot of people, really nice people in Reddit that post nice things about us all the time and defend us when other folks are putting us down. So we've seen some of that, but you know, so I don't want, sometimes we say something and then later.
Yeah. It's a small fraction.
Like, they hate Reddit, you know, but that's not the case. Yeah. I think the other thing is on the journey, what happens is that what I meant to say earlier is like when you start out, you're sensitive to that. You're looking at your metrics all the time. How many people are downloading? Where are we at? Da, 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 da. What's our growth curve? And then now at the point we're at now, we don't look at any of it. Probably to our detriment. Like, I mean, Forrest still looks at some reviews here and there. I don't engage in all that stuff anymore because I feel like the priority is just to keep ourselves true and do the show we started doing and keep our passion alive for the shows and the topics. To me, that's all we can do anyway. There's not a lot more of re-steering the ship. On the other hand, with some of the criticisms that came early on, I would say that criticisms we took that led to a better show was better control over our music and sound effects, getting that to a place that it needed to be at and when we use it. And also the cold open that tells the story. I took that directly from a group of criticisms about how bad we were at burying the lead, which we still are. We're still horrible at that. We're going to fix this. We're going to tell the story right at the beginning. You know, the meat of it right at the beginning. And then, yeah.
But it's here's the thing. Like I said, it is personal. What you notice is a lot of people don't listen very carefully. And that's fine. No one's making you take notes on this. But it's just be like, you know, you guys said this and I thought that was wrong. But then again, I may have not have heard because I was mowing the lawn. Okay. Well, that's cool. But and I'm glad you're doing this and that. But like, you know, you're doing it in the background while you're doing something else. Like I said, some of the things that you take to heart are there's different ways to tell a story, of course. I thought about this the other day. Now, this historical happening where this maybe something weird showed up in 1925 in this little town and it freaked people out. 50 people saw it at the town square. There's drawings that they're all different. It's like, okay, well, you can tell the history of that town because like, oh, well, that wasn't the first thing that happened there. Back in 1820, as the first founding happened, it's like there were earlier reports. And then if you go scroll back even further, there were Native American reports and some mythology about something similar that maybe just looks different to Westerners as they come in. And so do you start off with that very early instance or do you get right to the meat of it? And so a cold open is a way to do that, because what I point is that people will still complain. It's like, you didn't get to the story. Like, God, just stop talking about what's coming up for you guys on the podcast next week. I don't care. Just tell me what this thing is. And that's what I call the Wikipedia listeners. I got 20 minutes. Tell me everything about this I need to know so I can get on with my life. And it's like, fair enough. But here's the opening of the story. So you will do that, but then they will still like, I didn't get to it soon enough. So it's like, okay, didn't you hear that we basically gave you the nuts and bolts, at the beginning, and then we're giving you more detail. Yeah. The other way to do it is that you just do it totally linearly. And you start off like, you know, Native American legends go back 200 years before, through oral traditions. And then it came to, then you had settlers come in and they were seeing the same things. And then and then in 1923, it's like, well, that could be, you know, 45 minutes into the show till you get to... What's the freaky thing that everybody saw in 1925? So there are ways to do that. I would say if you're looking, what people should do, and they don't do this enough, I think, if things aren't working and you're getting too many complaints like this ain't, I don't know what's wrong, but this ain't right. Go listen to a show or watch a show that you really like and figure out what they're doing right. And then conversely, go look at something that you don't like and figure out like, what don't you like about it?
Yeah. And the other thing too, is that in the beginning, when you're starting out, the feedback that you're getting from your potential audience and the people you want to like you and listen to you, it's really important, because if you don't do it right, they're all going to go away before you even get a chance to get out of the gate. But after you've been doing it a long time and you get to a point where the show has solid numbers and good growth and has become a thing, then that feedback is less important because it becomes the minority. The majority is liking what you're doing, because or you wouldn't have gotten there. So that's why you don't want to change course too much.
Yeah. And that is the most important thing, I think, is that you have to be very meta, as the kids say, cognizant, self-cognizant. You have to be super honest with yourself. And you have to look at yourself just very, and again, it's hard to do because you're putting yourself out there. There are different genres, different types of mediums. I've always heard my dad, who's a commercial artist and painter, but also took photographer, cinematographer, videographer, and I learned all that from him. And we were talking about feedback when I was a kid. He's like, well, you're going to have to put up with that, you know, if you do paintings. But he said, I'll tell you, son, is, you know, there's a difference. Like a painter, the type of temperament is that you got all that on canvas and it could be just wild, abstract, whatever it is. And when you've got it all barfed onto the canvas, it's like, I'm done. That's it. He said, you could burn that painting. I don't care what your critique is of it. It's like, you're the dummy who paid the check for it. It's like, if I sold that to you bought it, like, I'm done with it. You got it all out of your head. It's there. Now the rest of you eggheads can argue about it. Writing is much different in that it's very personal.
Yeah.
These are your innermost thoughts and how you think characters should be and words they should say. And it's very personal. And when that gets criticized, that cuts even deeper. And so when you do a podcast, it's like, this is how I want the story to go. These are my thoughts about it. And somebody says, your thoughts are stupid. It's like, that's very personal. It's hard to take. Or I don't like the sound of your voice, or you're an egomaniac, or you're just a pompous blowhard. Those things can cut, and you need a thick skin to put up with it. But I would say, because the biggest thing in podcasting to be successful, and it's still said, we went to Podcast Movement 2 years ago, and Tom Webster from Edison Metrics, the company who studies, analyzes all the the metrics for podcasting and other media, the very number one thing is recommendability. Mm-hmm. You have to be recommendable to your friends, because it is still word of mouth how podcasts grow and spread.
That's right.
Nobody looks at an ad or you're just like, oh, iHeartRadio, well, they've got a new podcast. Well, okay, well, I like true crime. That sounds like a really interesting angle for a show. I might check that out. But really, it's your friends saying like, oh, dude, you got to listen to this. This blew my mind, Then you tune in. And so to do that, you have to do whatever you can professionally and not ignore that. Just like, it's good enough, No, that was our plan all along. Do everything we possibly can within our power to tick off all those boxes and make it as good as we can professionally. And we're still going to fail. We're still going to have shortcomings. But at least we did the effort to do everything that we could. And we still, like I said, we still stumble. It's like, we could have talked out that one section a little bit better. And you just keep learning. But that turning point is where you feel like, no, you know what? This is the way I wanted to do the show. Good or bad, fail, as Chris says, that's the hill you're going to die on. If it's like, no, this is the way I want to tell the story. And it's like, you have to be okay with that.
Yeah.
Within reason, like I said, if you're Dan Carlin, you can pull off 8 hours of a historical narrative telling that story, because the proof is in the pudding. Mm-hmm. He does it. He's successful. He's got a unique business model where it's just, I don't know if it's still a dollar a download or whatever, but that's how he wanted to do it. And it's like, it's work for him.
Yeah.
But you may not be Dan Carlin. And that's where your self-honesty has to come in. It's like, this is not my strength. It's really talking about pop culture and graphic novels and the things I like more, that I'm more expert at or whatever. I could talk about it with a little more aplomb and eloquence. Be honest with yourself and take that feedback. But you, like I said, Scott has to, as he said, you have to be also very self-aware, because you're going to get a lot of like, okay, what didn't you like about it? I don't know, but it sucks. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, that's not helpful.
Yeah,
because you'd be a little, I don't know, do something different. They don't know.
Yeah.
Or they're just trying to get a rise out of you. There's all these different things.
And that's the thing about, like what I was saying about SNL, the whole, that show hasn't been funny since 19, whatever, name your year, or 2000, go to that year and watch an episode, and I guarantee you there's at least 5 real stinkers in that episode. I don't care who it was. John Belushi, Eddie Murphy, there's stinkers in there, but it's just a way to be critical of people and give them a hard time and be negative about stuff. And there's no shortage of people who will tell you can't do something or you're doing it wrong whenever you set out on a creative endeavor. That's just the way the world is.
That is actually the only thing I have a degree in is film and television critical studies from USC. So So I remember one time, Scott and I were having a friendly argument, and he's like, well, what, he didn't say this because it's kind of rude, but it's like, what makes you an expert in this? Like, that's the only thing I have a degree in, is film and television criticism. I have a bachelor's. But what it did was teach me to think critically, to have a analytical mind about things and break it down. And because all we get in here, unless you witnessed it personally, you're getting a story. And you may think it was news, but here's the thing. It's like your idea of what the news is, and this will never change because it's still going on today. And we're seeing it, unfortunately, a lot today by evidenced as how divisive things are. But you go back to newspaper articles, and Scott and I learned this lesson over and again. It's like, well, we're not so sure this newspaper article is all that accurate. Because they want to sell papers, but guess what they want to do this week? And 10 years from now, they want to sell their medium. Mm-hmm. They don't do this for free. People will say, well, it was a Joseph Mulhattan story, that came out in 1890. Of course, it's a lie. It's like, well, the thing that we're covering, with Kincaid's Cave, it's like, he didn't write this. We don't know who did. We tried to research it. It may not be him. But a lot of stories then were spurious. A lot of reporting now is spurious because you don't have all the facts, but you got a deadline to reach. So you just put that out, let it get sorted out later.
Yeah.
And that's, you have to keep that in mind, is that, yes, everybody's selling something. That's just an old, tired argument and a way to like dismiss, throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's like, they ain't going to cut it for analytical thinking. And critical thinking is that you have to really look at everything and then make your own decision and accept the fact that you're probably still wrong about a lot of it. That's how you're going to get by. You know, that's good enough for me. At least I did the studying.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing that we love criticism. We love critics. We love skepticism. We just talked about the UAP hearing.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, we get blamed. It's like, well, you guys believe everything. It's like, well, no, I believe that the phenomenon is possible. Mm-hmm. And I believe that something is out there. I'm very skeptical about what it is, what's behind it, how it's happening, the reporting on it, and the manipulation that's going on behind the scenes. That I'm not buying into until we see more of the machinery, more of the sausage being made, the alien sausage being made. And so, you know, like I said, that I can't, you know, I'm not buying into just because the answer is I don't know.
Well, all right. On that note, I do want to talk about something that I actually talked about with Adam and Matt of Graveyard Tales. And you can go as deep or as shallow with this answer as you'd like. Scott, we'll definitely get to Sally House in a bit specifically.
But... We have to because I have a flask here that's being ignored.
We definitely will. But Forrest, has doing the show had any effect on your faith?
I think it's deepened it.
Has it really?
Well, I mean, here's your breadth of knowledge about things certainly has widened for me anyway. And so, you know, as a call back to earlier, the conversation here, Scott and I knew about certain things that were happening, but we didn't know a lot about them. It's just like, have you heard about this? He's like, yeah, what's going on there? It's like, I read an article that maybe said it was caused by this or that. It's like, yeah, me too. And then you start to really dive down, and that's been one of the indulgent and terrific things about doing a podcast is that you get to check out things that you're personally curious about. And nobody can tell you. They make suggestions and some great ones about topics, but really it's up to you what you cover. And so the things that we were always curious about, we got to learn more about. And as you do, your knowledge just technically of these things has deepened. And I would say the one thing that I'm trying to be good at is recognizing patterns and remembering callbacks and patterns and motifs that keep popping up. And why is that? Why is this one event very similar to this other thing that seems completely different? But these things within the event and the happening are oddly similar, like a weird beyond coincidence. As you put that together, as I say, everything, as I've learned, has come back to philosophy and about how you think about existence. And how you think about this, I think this is what we're seeing now is Sandy H. Crane, as you've seen in our group, teaches rhetoric. And he gave us an article, I still have to finish it, but it's basically about ontological shock. It's like the nature of reality and what's happening now in the news coming out. It's like, what do you mean there's weird stuff out there? That's real? It's, well, what does that mean for me? You know, my personal faith just spiritually has strengthened because the question is, what is true?
Mm-hmm.
And if all this weird stuff that's happening and told to you by people you trust as gospel, it was like, well, no, I saw this and it was not flying like an airplane. It was blinking, it zigzagged and shot off and disappeared in the sky. Whatever it is, or our good friend Rob's, you know, a kangaroo shaped kind of thing with a human face leapt out at me and my way to work. It's like, dude, I trust you. So that's weird. That should not happen. And yet it seemed to happen. And then if you accept that, then it's like, well, what is real? What are the boundaries? It's uncomfortable to think about. And so my place to retreat to is, you know, my personal beliefs as they've been formed, which have the knowledge and the technical aspects of it, of like what this or that may be or be similar to, has expanded. But I guess when I was younger in college, like you're trying to be more rational. Mm-hmm. Again, the critical thinking when you're first starting out in college, and it's like, I think I kind of got this down, and I think there are some things that just can't happen. They're impossible. And the hardest thing to let go now, studying all this, is that in whatever specific aspect, I'm not sure anything's impossible in a way. You know what I'm saying? Like, not that I could jump into a volcano and survive it. You know what I'm saying? That seems impossible. But I would say some things are just less probable.
Mm-hmm.
Some things are more unlikely to happen. And that's my gauge now.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. That's a great way to look at it. Scott, I know that I was there. I wasn't there with you guys at Sally House when you were there, but I was there to catch some of sort of your earliest, rawest reactions to what you guys were able to bring back with you from the Sally House, and you of course did a really excellent series on it for the show, and we'll link it in the show notes. On the topic of faith, personal or not, you know, you can go again as deep as you want with this. In retrospect, how had that experience that you had at the Sally House, how has it changed you? And I'm talking more long game here. I mean, how has it changed you since you had it, and now that you've had some time to think about it?
Well, I'm definitely a more spiritual person than I used to be before that. I think probably for me, what that experience confirmed for me was the presence of an unseen spiritual darkness is real. And as a result of an underlying philosophy that I already had, that's a sort of yin and yang balance of good and evil philosophy in the universe, that there is a balance. I'm not sure what's in charge of it, but I think something is, and I think it's sentient. Mm-hmm. So the weird thing is I came around to more faith than I used to have through coming face to face or face to ear with evil.
Mm.
Because I believe if the evil's there, then somewhere there's something that balances that out somewhere else. And both of those things are not tangible, but I believe in them.
Okay.
A question for me, Scott, we talked about this, but I was alluding to it, and I can't remember it's been so long ago, what your essential answer was or feeling, but do you think that you were more, not accepting of, but ready to believe in an evil force than a force for beautiful goodness?
No.
Did evil make more of an impression on you? Did it seem more real to you?
No, I mean, for folks that don't have any idea what we're talking about, we got a recording in an empty room of something very bizarre that shouldn't have happened at this house that we were examining almost on a lark while we were in town to talk about Amelia Earhart.
That Chris introduced us to.
I can't help but feel somewhat responsible for all this.
You are. We're just like, hey, we're here. We can get in there. You want to take a look? And it's like, okay.
If I'd have played that recording back and heard, you know, a choir of angels singing and had a beautiful, wonderful experience, that would have been fine. 1,000% okay with that. I was not seeking out evil. Yeah, and in fact, I think, as you know, I was incredulous that we were going to get anything at all
right
in that house.
Of course, but that analogy, I think, is perfect. Had you heard a voice on there that was a lovely, lilting, angelic woman that said, God bless you, Scott, would you have thought, like, okay, that's just an errant radio transmission from the country radio station?
No, I would have wondered about it because, you know, the thing, that the device we were using isn't a radio. So it's you know, doesn't even have an antenna.
Right.
Does have to, we went through this, but it has to accept interference because that's one of the FCC rules about any sort of device like that. But there's no interference to be had in the area because we looked into that too. And so we talked to ham radio people. We talked to a forensic audiologist. We talked to everybody. Nobody knows what's on that tape. And so had it been nice, I'm sure I probably might have preferred that because, you know, I had a long series of bizarre events and stress connected to the whole thing for more than 6 months after I got back. And it took some very specific circumstances to get them to stop. Yeah, I much would have preferred that would have been a nicer thing that was encountered. But whatever it was, you know, there's more to all that backstory than, you know, there's all the reactions we got from everybody who heard that recording.
Right.
Some stories we couldn't even tell on the air because they contained proprietary information relating to a large automobile manufacturer. So there's like, we know more than we're saying about it all. It's weird. That recording had, for lack of a better term, it had metadata in it, it seems like, where different people heard different things in it and different machines and sensors heard different things in it. I'll leave that at that.
All right. Well, I can't let you guys go without asking you about Amelia Earhart.
I don't know where she is.
Right. Okay. Well, I guess we...
Oh, I think he does. I think he does.
We might
have an idea.
We'll never know. You have both become obviously far more involved in the Earhart Noonan disappearance case than you probably ever wanted to at this point. I just want to give you the floor to talk about where you're both at with that right now. I've recently shared with you some of the very first footage. You guys actually are two of five people on the planet that have seen the footage or pieces of the footage from Buka 1 and Buka 2, including Mike Orange's ROV footage of the crash site. Mm-hmm. What are you thinking now that you've seen that footage? Does it strengthen Buka? Does it weaken it? The floor is yours, please.
For me, it absolutely strengthens it. I was blown away by the footage. You know, it's difficult, and I think people who have been involved in the investigation a long time probably get to a point where they're used to looking at the concretion of coral, which is something that when you first see it as a layman and somebody that you don't have experience with, you're like, what? It's like, I don't know. It's a mountain of coral. I don't know. But like once you kind of have to watch it over and over and do like you do with whatever. Forrest, I always ask you this. What's the name of the pictures that you stare at and the 3D thing pops out?
Well, that's colloquially.
Yes.
That is the magic eye. The magic eye.
Yeah. So then you do that thing where you relax your iris and then you see an image.
That blows me away.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild.
You're shifting your depth of focus, and that's the thing. You start to see these things in the coral, and so you have to be careful of pareidolia and seeing things that you're not seeing, but like the footage that you shared, am I allowed to discuss objects I saw in the footage?
Sure.
Okay. There is it's a super obvious wheel. It's a wheel. And you can see that it's a wheel. You can see a lot of other things, too. I don't want to overshare.
Could be a Weber barbecue.
Yeah, no, but the point is just that, you know, there's no question that there is a man-made aircraft in the water here where Bill Snavely thinks it is. Based on all the prior expeditions and the information related to it, I think that there is a far better than 50% chance that is an Electra 10E.
Mm.
Now, that may open up a whole new can of questions. I don't want to... I know where Bill's line of reasoning is right now, and I don't necessarily want
to
share that because I think he's keeping that a little bit of that under wraps. But
sure.
I guess what I will say is none of it goes against what our initial philosophies were when we did episodes 3 and 4 of our show, which I think is really cool. Are you allowed to talk about Buca 3, Chris?
Yeah, sure.
Why don't you tell? I want to know what is Buca 3?
So Buca 3 is, well, I can tell you what the potential is for Buca 3. Buca 3 potentially is the CASE's first cross theory collaborative effort ever. The big selling point for Buca 3 is that we've got multiple people from multiple camps that are actually going out and joining forces and actually helping Snavely determine what this actually is. Out at Buca, Dick Spink from Japanese Capture and Lost Evidence is going to captain one of Martin Daly's ships out to Buca and spend anywhere between 20 to 30 days out at the crash site with the right equipment. Tom Detweiler is a rumor, but I got it on pretty good authority at this point that he's going to probably be the operations manager for it. So you'll have Snavely there, you'll have Crash and Sink there, you'll have Japanese Capture there. He's also got Kenton Spading, and he's got a couple other folks formerly from Tiger that are working on the research side of things. So you've got really a lot of major key players that are coming together to determine whether or not this is either the plane or it's something else entirely. And we have a feeling.
Is there any need for a couple of bozos?
There's always more room for bozos. We can stick you guys wherever if you want. It's cross-collaborative, and it's groundbreaking.
Right.
If anyone follows the show, and we have some listenership now, it's become a tradition of sorts that we end each show with our version and really our homage really to the Colbert questionnaire. It's 15 quick questions that tell us a little more about you guys, and I think your audience will probably enjoy this. So let's run through them. Mm-hmm. Scott, what is the best sandwich?
The best sandwich. The best sandwich for me, honestly, it's an old standby. It's a tradition. I have it regularly. Is frankly a well-made BLT.
I think my wife would agree with that. So I think you've got a fan in Vanessa for that. Forrest, what about you, sir? What is the best sandwich?
I would say it's a number one and then a close second. Probably the Reuben. I think there's a lot of flavor combination going on there. It's one thing I order if I see it being offered on a menu to gauge how well the restaurant is overall. If they can make a good Reuben, they know what they're doing. The second is more of a dessert sandwich, as I would call it, but it's the Monte Cristo.
Ooh.
Just because it's like it's a dessert and a sandwich rolled into one and served with powdered sugar and jelly. What are you doing here?
Yeah.
Melted cheese and ham. There's a lot going on, but it is like a it's like an omelet sandwich mixed in with a regular sandwich, but French toast. It's just there's a lot going on.
All right. Good picks. All right. Forrest, what's the one thing you own that you really should throw out?
Massive spring cleaning phase that's gone through into the summer, but I haven't gotten to it yet. I imagine here's my dilemma. There's probably a lot, but I would say I do have memorabilia and tchotchkes that, you know, Marie Kondo would say, like, you have to decide if it gives you joy. And I don't know if it does anymore. I haven't looked at them for a long time, but I would say it is stuff that, here's my philosophy on it. If you throw it out, could you get it back again? If it's something that's like, man, here's a coin that I got at this, you know, even it's a stretched penny, and it was just a great day with my grandparents, and they paid for that, and they gave me this penny at this old West Saloon, whatever it was. And it's like, well, I don't really need this stretched penny. It's like, well, there's a lot of memories that
sentimental value
go with that. Yeah, and I mean, there's some stuff, like one that's kind of on the fence, though, is that like a lot of grandparents, my great-grandmother would just go to the drugstore when she was there, and she would just buy knickknacks for me, you know, like just, it doesn't matter what they are, but she bought me like a little stand-up shaving mirror.
Yeah,
that thing is probably 40 years old. Or 45 years old, maybe. And she was just like, oh, here you go. I got some stuff for you. It'd be like a nail clipper and a comb. And those are just common items. I can easily get another mirror, but I can't get the one that she gave me. And so, like, I'll use it till, God forbid, it breaks or something. Like I said, I can't get back that memory.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of hard. So anyway, yeah, probably a lot of just tchotchkes I've picked up over the years. I thought was kind of cool. And when I get to them, clearing them out, I'll make a snap decision.
All right. Scott, what about you?
For me, it's funny. I've moved a lot. My wife and I've moved a lot. And every time we've gone much further with paring things down. At one point, we even rented a 10-yard dumpster and filled it with stuff from a basement.
Wow.
We're like, why are we taking this to all these different houses? And we threw out a lot of stuff. But I still have, and it's not really one thing, it's more of a type of thing. I still have too many post-production facility swag t-shirts that I got back from when I worked in Los Angeles.
Propaganda's out.
Many places that aren't in business anymore.
eBay.
eBay.
Man.
Make some money off that. Come on, Scott.
Pacific Ocean Post.
Hey.
You know, my POP shirt, 11 Sound shirt, my,
Nostalgia's a big market right now.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. Start thinking about your, speaking of market, think about, you put your business acumen in it. These are people who made pretty good livings, and a lot of them are multimillionaires now, who would pay for something that they can't, like I said, you can't get that back.
Yeah, that's true.
And those were the salad days of music videos.
Yeah, it was. And there was a lot going on.
High budget commercials and a lot more than we see now, which people just don't. I don't know. Those were the salad days, I think, of post production, and they will pay a pretty penny for that.
Well, maybe so, I'll do that.
I'm telling you, man.
They don't smell.
Go
good.
For it. All right, this is going to be a good one. This is going to be a good one, and I'll let you guys go cryptid if you want. Scott, what is the scariest animal?
The scariest animal. I don't have, you know, like, I don't have any phobes. Like, sometimes they would say, oh, do I have an arachnid phobia? But I don't really. I don't love spiders, but, like, I'm not, they don't freak me out.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to go with an old chestnut, really, of something that we've talked about on the show. And in terms of its danger, probably a cassowary.
kicking at you, like they're doing the...
Yeah, with its big dinosaur foot.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll kill you. They'll kill you.
Right.
And they look ridiculous. You'll be laughing the whole time.
Yeah.
As it's just completely eviscerating you. It's up there. Also, I'm going to say two. Also, a shark. I've been in the ocean a lot.
Lot
this summer. You know, lucky for me. But whenever I'm out there, I wonder about what's swimming just a few feet away that I don't know about.
They have their different angles.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, here's the thing. It's like, I think there's a lot of psychology that also goes on with that. Sharks, it's a big, murky, unless you're scuba diving, and then maybe you have a better visibility, but you don't know what's down there.
No,
there's all kinds of weird stuff. And they sneak up on you.
Yeah, and all the patterns, because the temperatures are all whack right now, so all the predictability about where they are is a little bit out the window at the moment.
Yeah. At the worst, you're going to get bit on the wedding tackle by an angry otter. That seems biting surfboards.
So what's yours, Forrest? What's your scariest?
Here's the thing. The thing I'm most likely to run into, and I have been in their territory, and I've talked about this on the show about, when we talk about fear of the paranormal, fear of the supernatural, and those kinds of things, you know, whether you're afraid or you believe in them or not, my attitude is that I don't necessarily fear it, but I'm very respectful of its power to harm you. And so the thing that I would most likely, yes, I have been in the ocean, love it in Hawaii, but, and that's probably, you know, that's jellyfish, and that's annoying and painful.
Well, I can speak to that. I've had a jellyfish wrapped around my leg before, and it's not fun.
Oh,
yeah, it's not fun. My oldest brother did too. We used to surf years ago, and it's not fun.
Yeah.
So
hot, stinging pain, like it's lighting your nerves on fire,
like a fire that's inside your body that you can't put out. You know?
Yeah, under your skin that you can't do anything about.
Yeah.
So there's that. That's not really, I wouldn't want to be accidentally just swimming up through a Spanish man of war.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I would be most likely to encounter would be a mama grizzly.
Mm.
And that is, there's nothing more dangerous animal-wise or fearsome, powerful on Earth.
Yeah.
No, I'm not probably going to go on an African safari. So I will not come across lions, tigers, rampaging bull male elephants. So probably the grizzly is a thing that I respect. And I have been in their territory. And there's things you can do. But some, you know, sometimes, like I said, they are most dangerous, of course, when their two cubs are around. And if you're just poking around, you're going to get... Was it Henry Glass? That was a terrific story.
The Revenant.
That was the Revenant.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot like that.
Yeah, yep. But that is a true story. But like, you next thing you know, you're poking around. It's like, oh, her cubs are behind you. And then she comes barreling out and they're, you know, they can rip a door off a car. You know, so I cannot do that. I mean, here's, so yeah, I'm very respectful and I'm very aware and you may or may not survive. The thing, of course, that you can, if you're unarmed, is they tell you to climb the right size tree and they tell you that in Glacier Park, which is a place I love. And it's like, what do you mean the right size? Like, well, if it's too big of a tree with low-hanging branches and it's easy to climb, she's coming after you. If it's too small, she's going to knock it over. You know, it could be male or female grizzly. But so it has to be the right size where it's like, it's too small for them to get a grip on, but just big enough that they can't shove the tree over. So.
Jesus.
The other one is a rogue Bigfoot. But then again, that's probably not very
those
likely.
Those are the ones that, that you don't just wink at you through the bushes. They're the ones that run towards you and break your body in half.
Well, they rip you in two and stuff you into a tree hole.
That's good. Lord. That's a real story.
To make a point.
Well, you never know.
Yeah.
All right, here's the next one. Apples or oranges, Scott?
Oranges.
Forest?
I would say oranges. Yeah, I like them both, but oranges if I had to choose one.
All right. Two for two. All right. Scott, have you ever asked, this is an interesting question. Maybe you have, maybe you haven't. Have you ever asked anyone for their autograph?
Yes, I have. Not a lot. Mm-hmm. Thanks to my wife, I've met a lot of people, and it was like kind of the last thing you do in those circumstances. Sure. The very last, you just treat them like normal people if you want them to talk to you and whatever. But I did just last week, anyway, I asked for an inscription from Ralph Blumenthal, who was an author that we just talked to. You know, he broke the original New York Times story along with Leslie Kane and Helene Cooper on UFOs. And we had him on a few weeks ago, and he, I sent his latest book and another book up to him where he's teaching at Phillips Exeter Academy for the summer, and asked him to sign them, and he autographed them both and sent them back to me. But that's because I'm like kind of a book collector nerd. So
that's cool. That's cool. Yeah. I like it. That's a good one. Forrest, what about you, sir?
I'm of the same attitude. I have run across a fair number of celebrities and famous people, of course, living here in LA all these years. But I don't bother them. I've talked to a few, but only if it's a natural occurrence where you're just standing there, and it would be weird if you didn't say something.
Yeah.
But generally I don't, I'm not real big on, not that impressed. But one time, this is right out of college when you're struggling for work and taking a bunch of freelance jobs. I was, trying to get work as an extra in different movies. And so, you know, it'd be like $30 for the day plus a free meal. It's like, hey, that's more than I'm making at home and better food than I would microwave for myself. So there was one, it was like a TV movie that, and this came up again, Heather Locklear. That's kind of, we're just, all these recurring themes for us. But she was one of the stars of this TV movie that they were shooting, and I was just a background extra, and I started chatting up with this other young dude, and we were kind of just milling around, hanging out by the trailers, the Star Wagons, and he goes, dude, it's Tommy Lee, his Porsche just pulled up. Really? And I grew up in high school, you know, listening to Motley Crue a little bit, but wasn't all that, you know, not a huge fan. And I go, oh, look at that. Well, I guess you're right. There's this Porsche, and he gets out, and he's just kind of sitting, you know, at the stoops of the trailer. And I thought, like, oh, yeah, he's dating Heather Locklear. Okay, that makes
sense. That's right.
And so the guy goes, dude, we got to go get his autograph. We got to go talk to him. It's like, no, don't bother him. I mean, he's, you know, don't. He's like, come on, I'm doing it. It's like, all right, fine. So I walked with him and walked up to Tommy Lee. And he's like, man, I'm a huge fan. I'm like, whatever, can we get your autograph? He's like, yeah, sure.
That's cool.
So he had a, I think the guy I had, you know, he had a little scrap of paper that maybe had some call sheet notes, you know, call time notes on or whatever. So he signed that and he signed one for me, like, you know, rock on, Tommy Lee.
That's cool.
I was like, that's pretty cool. And we chatted a little bit, and you know, he told us a story that he goes, yeah, man, I just almost just got kicked out by the security guard because, you know, I got out like my kid and I had a needle in it. And he said, they're doing drugs here, man. And he's like, no, I'm diabetic. So he almost got kicked. He's like, I'm not doing drugs. I need this. It's insulin. Anyway, so he told that story. It's like, well, okay, there you go. I didn't really have to bother him for it. He gave it up, and I got a cool autograph. And then a friend of mine who's a bigger Tommy Lee fan. I like the guy a lot. But But she was very excited that I got this autograph, and I mailed it to her, and within a few days, she lost it. So,
man.
So there you go. So I have no autographs now, other than like some signed books, which I'm very proud to have. Yeah.
All right. We have 16 minutes to get through the rest of these questions.
Okay.
Let's knock them out. Let's rapid fire.
Rapid fire.
Okay. Yeah. Scott, what do you think happens when, as I ask this question too, it's a heavy one. Scott, what do you think happens when we die?
I think our life force continues, but I'm not positive that we're aware of the transition, just that we keep going and that we don't necessarily understand what's happening, and maybe we become part of a collective thing or something like that.
I like it. Forrest, thoughts? What happens when we die?
Yeah, I was raised fairly traditionally, not with any particular denomination, but, raised Christian and still adhere to those principles. But so I do believe in a form of heaven or communion with God, in that you come back into the fold in some way. But I also do believe, and also a lot of it for the show, it's stuff that I believed before we started the show. I believe in that reincarnation is possible, and there's some very startling and head-scratching anecdotes about that and instances where people have provided that. So I do believe that it's a transitional phase. There is no death per se. No one ever really dies. But some people may be stuck because they have resisted. Something within them resists that transition into the fold to be to kind of spit out again into maybe another life in this never-ending thing.
Okay, I just wanted to, I've gotten a habit. I have a deck of spiritual cards here. I've gotten a habit of when we're doing Zooms of drawing them randomly.
Wow.
And I want to know the one I just pulled out of the deck right here. While Forrest was saying that, it's a butterfly and it says transformation.
That's awesome.
There you go.
That's kind of crazy, right? That's how many cards are in this deck. And that's what I pulled out.
Very cool.
So, there you go. It's from the larva to the chimera to the butterfly, the chrysalis and all that.
You're going to have to get back to apples and oranges if you want us to answer.
No, that was a heavy one. That was
a deep one.
Unless you're an atheist, then it's dirt nap, you can believe that, but it's just the most boring answer ever.
Right. All right, well, this might be a little bit easier one. Scott, what is your favorite action movie?
My favorite action movie is probably, let me think. It varies. It changes.
Yep.
And if
pick a hot one,
I mean, I like so
pick
many.
A hot one.
I'm probably gonna say, honestly, I'm gonna say The Man Who Would Be King.
Okay, okay.
Ooh.
That's a deep pick. I like that. That's a good one. Forrest, what's yours?
I would say, well, there is when I was in college, it would have been Mad Max.
Oh yeah,
The number two or the first one, because there's a lot going on, and I love cars and machinery and that kind of the machine punk kind of feeling. Now I would say the movie that I can turn on and watch just sections of, and I think it's expertly packaged, is Terminator 2.
Yeah.
As soon as they get in that building and he's got the minigun, and it just takes off, like it's just a roller coaster ride to the end.
Yeah, I like it.
So I can watch any bits of that. Yeah.
All right. So, Scott, what is your favorite smell?
honestly, one of my favorite smells is the, it doesn't happen every time, but here in the South, in North Carolina, where I live, it's a fresh rain, the rain that has kind of like almost an ozone tinge to it.
What's the smell of that? There's a name for that.
I don't know. I keep trying to remember that smell. It's very
There is a name. Yeah, like the hot rain on hot pavement.
I'll go with that.
That is a good smell. Forrester, what is your favorite smell?
Well, you're lucky here in a short answer, because I have seen Colbert quite a bunch and have seen this, and I thought about this answer, what I would give if I was sitting on the couch there. It's a toss-up between books, like the smell of book pages and leather.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Those are some good ones. You
so a leather-bound book is both leather-bound book of both worlds.
That'll render you catatonic, right?
I will sniff it quite a long time.
Probably. All right. Let's see. Well, let's do the reverse then. Scott, what's your least favorite smell?
My least favorite smell. It's probably baby poop, frankly.
That's the most popular answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody else's baby is worse than your own. I don't know why that is, but definitely someone else's baby's poop.
Yeah, because it's like your own poop. You have to sit over it every day of your life almost if you're.
It's like that Carlin joke. Yeah. Like, do you ever notice how like other people's stuff is shit and your shit is stuff?
Look at all
that's
crap.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Someone else's shit is on the dresser. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, what about you, sir? Forrest.
I will say just naturally that you have to put up with for a certain season here in L.A. I don't care for the smell of jacaranda trees.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of people like, it's like my least favorite tree. I think it, some people will say it's like, oh, it's just a floral smell. I think it smells like pee. Mm. And for about a week and a half, 2 weeks, the purple blossoms are lovely and the tree, they're all blooming. And then right after that, they all drop to the ground and it's a sticky mess. And I also don't care for their scraggly bark. So yeah, but they're all over LA. There's,
oh yeah, and I can't stand, nice. There's a flower. It's like a lily. It's like white with like pink, like the big, that is in every arrangement that everyone ever gifts to you.
Yeah.
I hate that flower. I hate it.
Really?
Yeah, it
really?
Gives me a headache. I think I might be allergic. I hate
that
smell. That's actually worse than somebody else's baby poop.
Wow.
All right. So we got a new number one takeover there. Yeah. All right. All right. Scott, is exercise worth it?
Yes, absolutely.
Forrest?
I've not heard that question asked on the show. Here's the thing. It's an answer that, a short answer that I heard given by World According to Garp, the author. He wrestled in college. I think he was a great wrestler, and I wrestled a little bit in high school. People asked him, like, well, why do you do all the wrestling? Because he became a successful author and had a wrestling mat in his yard with his sons.
John Irving,
yes. And so they would practice, and they're like, why do you lift weights? And he says, I think the person was trying to say, like, well, are you vain? Are you trying to look good? And he's like, I do it for stamina.
Mm-hmm.
As a writer, as a creative thinker, and to spend long times writing, and I thought, like, yeah, that's what it's worth. It's, to me, it's like I try to get back into jogging, not only because, yeah, it's good for your health and your organs and all that functioning, but I want the strength and I want the stamina.
Mm.
And I can't really control how I look nowadays. That's a runaway train to Flabville. Yeah. But at least I can have a little bit more stamina. Yeah.
All right. Scott, what is the most used app on your phone?
It's probably an app called My Radar. It's a weather radar thing.
All right. Really? All right. Forrest, what about you, sir? What is the most used app on your phone?
Boy, depends on the time of day. If I'm cooking, usually it's Pandora. Because if I have to follow a recipe, I can't listen to a podcast. Sometimes I'm listening to podcasts. Right. So podcast app, but I can't concentrate if somebody's speaking and I have to follow a recipe. So but I know what I'm making, I will, or just washing dishes, it'll be Pandora. But mostly I would say, probably just the mail app. But there's also here's the one I should be using the most, is an ESP app that was developed by Russell Targ and a Stanford Research Institute to just kind of a train you thing. And it's just four pictures and you try to guess the color. There's four colors. And so you tap on one of the four squares to try and guess what square the picture has under it.
Okay.
And I think the best I've gotten is a little over half of them out of 24, as they call them, trials. And it's like when it dings, it's very satisfying. And it freaks you out. Like it keeps going like, oh my God, I can't miss.
Yeah. All right. Last two questions of the night.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can go surface level with this or you can get as deep as you want. Forrest, tell me something that you used to value that you no longer value today.
Ooh. Okay. That one I had not thought about. And in advance, but it is something I think we should all ponder, the unexamined life and all that. I don't know, maybe people's, I mean, I still care about it, maybe people's opinion about me, when it would bother you, and it's very hard to get over. Not that you shouldn't care, because you don't want to be a jerk, okay? It's like you do want to consider, like, wow, nobody's really getting along with me or liking me. And then you should probably consider what you're doing. But I think maybe that and just moving ahead, and I think maybe where I'm at with my life at this age, in that, okay, so much amazing stuff, I say, to wrap this around and bookend it, this all had to be the time it took in itself for us to get where we are. And I can't beat myself up. It's like, man, it's like, look, I'm this age. It's like, I don't have a house, don't have a family. I do have a car and an apartment, same one, you know, for 35 years. It's like, don't beat yourself up. It's going to take this long. You know, it's going to happen, but you still have to do the work. And I think, you know, whatever's gone or lost time, it's like, you can't beat yourself up about that. You can't go back and make a new beginning, but you can start any time to make a new ending.
Damn. That's a great one. Scott, thoughts?
My presence on the internet, social media, all of that kind of stuff.
Well, that's a mental health one. That's a good one.
Yeah, I've parted ways.
Self-care.
With most of it. The stuff that we need to do for the show, I'm still into, but I no longer have a Facebook profile, an Instagram profile. I manage our Twitter still.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy that one because of its interactive nature and how it works. And I manage Discord, but that's not really social media. I mean, it's not a posting thing. That's servers where you talk to people. The other stuff, I don't want to do anymore, and I don't care about doing it, and I don't care what's on it. I don't look at it. So, yeah. And I've been happier for that.
I like the fun videos. Yeah. But
yeah, but I don't even care about those. I mean, I've seen every fun video. I know. There is, you've know? Like,
I know. Like, you've got,
they're all the same, you know, cute cat. Well, you know, somebody fell on the ice, whatever. It's like, I'm bored with it, but also not interested in participating in it anymore.
Yeah.
I'd rather read a book or walk my dog or go outside or swim in the ocean or where the sharks are. Something like that.
Well, Chris, I'm sure as you know, as you get older and you know, you're a father now and you have different priorities and things that matter to you as you age that you can have in your head conceptually when you're younger, but you can't feel it until you get there.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And for the record, Forrest, you and I made the same choice. My choice when someone asked me that was really just... You know, if you're not in my inner circle, if you're not people I love, I care about, you're not friends, you're not family, I really don't care about your opinion about me personally, because we're putting ourselves out into a medium, into on platforms where everybody can take a jab at you. And I've been, you know, it's interesting, Scott, you talk about, and we'll wrap with this, but talking about your wife and going through SNL, I remember one night I had been struggling a lot with the Chasing Earhart stuff and trying to get people to come onto the show. And I remember I really wanted Mike Campbell, right?
Yeah.
And Mike Campbell is like the definitive. I mean, he wrote The Truth. It's the book. You guys talk about it in your show and your piece you did on Earhart. I was such a big fan. And at the time, I was getting sort of torn to shreds from like every you know, different which way. And I remember emailing Mike Campbell, and the response I got from him was, I would rather put a shotgun on my mouth than go on your show. And that was at the end of a particularly brutal week for me. And I remember wanting to give up the show at that point. And I remember my wife looking at me and telling me in retrospect, like, I my heart broke for you in that moment.
Yeah.
And so I really resonated with Scott was talking about earlier about, you know, his wife, you know, putting herself out there. It's a creative piece. Hollywood's it's insane. I'm sure I don't have, you know, I'm not into that, so I'm not privy to that. But like, I can imagine that must be heartbreaking for someone that you love so much to watch them go through that kind of, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's difficult. It's very difficult to move. And so to your point, Forrest, that's the one thing that I thought other people's opinions. There's no room. You got to cut fat at some point.
Yeah.
There's no room in your life for it.
Exactly. And it, as you said, it owes to self-care and your own mental health. But, and here's the other thing too, as you get older and it is more of a relief and more dangerous, is that I don't know if it's the weakening of the filter, but my attitude now is that if somebody said that to me and said that, it's like, you don't have to be an ass. And for somebody to have said that as a response, it's like, I don't now want to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you may have a good product and this is interesting, but like, I'll just dig out of your book. It's like, it's there. Mm-hmm. And we see this on the show too. It's like, there's a lot of people we'd love to talk to. And then we realize like, well, you don't really have to, we're going to give a good rundown analyzation of the book, be fair to it, be objective. It would be great to talk to them because I think they're interesting people. And we've never really had somebody who's too prickly, but you know, there's nobody who's been kind of an ass. It's like, if that's you, here's the thing. You could have just said like, sorry, Chris, I'm really busy. I'm starting another project.
Yeah.
So let me, I'll get back to you in 2 years. Sorry, I know it's a long time, but you don't have to be a dick.
Right.
And to somebody who that's their response, it's like, you sound like an ass, sir. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the thing. I don't need to talk to you. You don't really need me. I don't really need you. Your stuff is out there for me to analyze anyway. But, you know, and it is an interview show and I realize that. But, you know, I've never really had to deal with prickly people. Back at USC, I did get a chance to interview somebody that I liked as a director, and it was Wim Wenders, and I still like his stuff, but I was kind of, he was cranking a lot of films and I was in that mode, but he was a little prickly and I had 20 questions and it's just like, I just remember him getting through that and he was being difficult. And he's got a bunch of interviews that day, I know, with a bunch of college kids, but it's just like, it's like, well, what do you think of winning this award for Wings of Desire? He's like, well, I don't care about the award, because something you put out your mouth, and it's like, well, you obviously put the film forward to win one. He goes, well, I guess that's true. So I did, at the end of it, Eddie's looked at me, I guess out of questions. And it's like, yeah, I guess you're out of answers. And it's just like, okay, I didn't need that, but don't meet your heroes.
This has been a pleasure, a genuine pleasure. You know, I love you guys both. You know, your friends, your brothers, I appreciate you both. Thank you for doing the show. Plug for people who are living under rocks and don't know of Astonishing Legends, because I think most people do at this point. Can you please just run through some plugs? Like, plug away. We want to get everything. We'll have links to everything, of course, as well. But Scott.
Yeah, it's Astonishing Legends is a podcast. We're closing in on 9 years old now. You can find us anywhere you get podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, I would say Stitcher, but they're done. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts. Right. You can find us at our website, astonishinglegends.com, where we've got all our episodes, which have their own pages up there. You can ask your smart speaker to play us. We're on, even though I said I didn't run them all, but we are on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. We have a Facebook group that's very active, a wonderful community, a Facebook private group. Page. We have a Discord server, and we have what else for us? I can't think.
Well, if you want to see me sweaty, pudgy, and stumbly, you can check out History's Greatest Mysteries.
Oh yes,
yes.
There's a few coming out.
Yes, and lots of episodes.
Yes,
yes, and we have a YouTube channel.
Yes,
yes, yes. Yeah. We are fellow History's Greatest Mysteries alum now. You and I. So
that's true. That's true. Yeah, you're on one, and check out Chris's. Does a lot better than I do.
Well,
he looked like somebody who knew what he was talking
about. I wouldn't say that. But I appreciate that, and I would not have happened without your blessing and your encouragement. So thank you.
Absolutely, sir. So yeah, just wherever you get your crap, and we're all running the same circles, which I love, that we all kind of getting to know the same people. So yeah, astonishinglegends.com, all of our business is there.
All right. Well, as we exit tonight, the show is Astonishing Legends. Links to everything we covered in the show notes for tonight's episode.
Oh, and the Midnight Library.
Midnight Library link. Oh, we'll definitely link Midnight Library for sure.
Check that out.
We'll link it all tonight. So, guys, thank you so much, both of you. Appreciate you both. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Talk to you soon.
Thanks for having us.
Another conversation behind us. Thanks for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air. News, show information, and more. Go to facebook.com/meandmyfriendspod. On Twitter, you can search the handle meandmyfriendspod. And on Instagram, search the handle meandmyfriendspod. If you enjoyed the conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to Apple Podcast or your favorite podcatcher and rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. The show's music is created and performed by producer Riddiman. The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Eben Films Incorporated. Chris Eben Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris Eben Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Eben Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris Eben Films production. All rights reserved.